Okay, great. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us today, Hank. This oral history interview is being conducted by the Area 53 Archives Committee to pass on the history of our fellowship through the shared memories of one of our members. No duplication or reuse of this interview beyond sharing on platforms of the Area 53 Archives Committee is authorized without the express written consent of the member being interviewed and the Area 53 Archives Committee. Today, we are interviewing Hank W. from Baltimore. His sobriety date is December 25th, 1989, and his home group is the Baltimore Open Discussion Group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. And today's date is April 29th, 2021. So, Hank, to get us started, could you tell us a little bit about your life before you found AA, such as where you were born, what happened a little bit as you were growing up, and where you lived and grew up?
Sure. So I was born in Ironwood, Michigan, which is in the Upper Peninsula. And my father was a Presbyterian minister, so I'm a PK. And we moved from there. I had three sisters. At that time, the third one was born a little later on. But we moved from Ironwood down to Napoleon, Ohio, and then my dad was there 5 years, and we moved to Circleville. So I grew up. I mean, my early childhood would have been Napoleon. I mean, we moved away from Ironwood when I was maybe 6 years old, so I don't remember much of it, other than the fact I fell into a snowbank and my mom couldn't find me, but that was a moment of panic. So I grew up in Circleville, and I tell people, that I looked like Opie from Mayberry RFD. I had red hair, freckles, but my personality was much more. Was I was just an ordinary kid. I had a loving family, and I had a good childhood, and my parents gave me everything that they could. Ministers aren't wealthy, but I had a good life, and my mom was a Baptist through and through. Had worked for Reverend Moody in Chicago, and that's where my dad and her met. Was my dad was in seminary, and my mom was working for the Moody Bible Institute. So my mom was a through and through Baptist, and so but for some reason, my personality was Eddie Haskell, and I was just that kid. I'd go to church with my mom. My dad would already be there in his robes, and I had my little sport coat on, and I had these. Back then, they gave you a little ribbon on your when you went you graduated your first Sunday school, and then every year after that, you got another ribbon tacked onto it. So I had this campaign ribbon, showing that I was a good Christian kid. And I'd go to church with my mom, and I'd walk in, and I was that kid that I'd look around and I'd go, "My, Mrs. Brown, your hair looks really nice," And when she turned around, I'd mutter under my breath, "Boy, you got a fat butt," and my buddies would all laugh. And my mom was constantly going, "What did you say something to Hank?" And I'd go, "No, I didn't say anything." I was that kid that talked out of the side of his mouth, and I was a liar and a thief from Jump Street. And I tell guys I sponsor, this started way before I took my first drink. My character defect started way before I took my first drink. I was a liar and a thief, and I used to sneak into that big old church. And back then, they had these little cardboard churches for the one great hour of sharing, and I'd sneak in there on Saturday and take a little out of each one, And that's a beautiful church down there, and they have these stained glass windows on both sides, and one is Jesus Christ with his descending dove coming down. And no matter where you were in the sanctuary, Jesus was watching me. And so I had the guilt and the shame, knowing I was doing something I shouldn't do. And then I'd slip out the back door and go to the Five and Dime and do retail therapy so I didn't feel so bad. And I'd buy all this junk the kids buy, comic books and toy soldiers and stuff. And I'd be walking back home, and I'd be eating the candy as fast as I could, because I knew if I ran into my dad, my dad gave me, I think, a big 75 cents a week allowance for cutting the grass. And he was going to say, where'd you get the money for that, boy? You know, and so I was already thinking up the lie before I got home and trying to figure out where I could hide this stuff. So that's before I had my first drink, you know, and my first drink was, Presbyterians drink grape juice for communion, but the Lutherans right across the street, they drink Mogan David wine. So I became buddies with the Lutheran minister's son, this kid by the name of Larry Egbert. And Larry and I would go to the basement of my church, and they had those nickel Coke bottles. And in the furnace room were 5 gallons of grape juice in this jug with a pump. We'd fill up Coke bottles, and then we'd slip across the street to the Lutheran church and dump the grape juice in their wine bottles and pump the wine out. And then we'd go in the alley and get consecrated. You know, I spent one summer just doing communion. We left out the Wonder Bread. So
Hank, how old were you when that kind of fun stuff started?
Well, I was probably in sixth grade, seventh grade, you know, and so that just that behavior just continued like most kids, you know. As soon as my first buddy got a car, then we started running. And back then it was not uncommon to get your temporary license at 15 and a half and your driver's license at 16. And I managed to total 3 of my dad's cars, and he loved cars. And I totaled 3 of them before he took away my driving privileges for good.
Did that have anything to do with some drinking?
It always did. It always did. You know, I think the first big wreck I got into was, we would, if you're familiar with Circleville, my dad would let me drive his car to choir practice. So I'd pick up a buddy and we'd leave early. And I'd tell him, oh, I want to leave a little early so I'm not late. And then we'd race down to the Logan Elm Bar and Motel. And there was a barmaid there that if we gave her enough compliments, she'd slip us some beer out the back door. And the first time I missed a curve coming back a country road trying to get to the choir practice on time, I took out the front of his New Yorker, took off the whole front of it. And, you know, and I just thought it was a Dukes of Hazzard moment. You know, I didn't think it had anything to do with the beer. It was the gravel in the driveway and on the road. They just put gravel down. That's what I told my dad. My dad just kind of shook his head. You know, my dad had his own story before he became a minister. He was a wild man, you know. He had something, he had a moment of epiphany in his life that he decided to become a minister, but that's his story. And but he probably knew and just shook his head, you know, and figured, oh, God, I'm glad he's alive. He never, every time I wrecked a car, he always told me how scared he was and how happy he was that I didn't get hurt. He never did what I would have expected, wrecking a car, because I know he didn't have the money to fix it, you know. That just continued, you know. Back then, driver's licenses were paper, and you just scuff up the date and get a little white out and type a new date in there. And so I had a fake driver's license, you know, and as long as nobody looked at it real close. So we'd always try to find dive bars to buy our beer in, you know. And then sometimes we'd go to, there was a carryout called Cocktail Corners, and we'd slip in there and steal cherry vodka and stuff like that, you know. Yeah, so my drinking started then. And I never drank to fit in. I didn't care about fitting in. I drank because I like to get buzzed. I like that feeling of being out of control.
So we're going to just speed this up in this beginning part a little bit so we can get to some the recovery, unity, and service portions. So would you want to share anything about like what you did for a living, your career?
Sure.
If you had a family of your own, and just a little bit there, and then we'll move into the kind of the end.
So I went to Vietnam.
Okay.
Came back with all that baggage.
Oh, yeah.
And I met my wife. She was 17 when I met her, and just turning 18, and she had, you know, red hair, blue eyes, and wore peasant blouses, which I really liked. And she believed everything I told her. Trust me, I screwed that up. But the long and short of it is that we did a lot of We did a lot of travels before we ever had a family. So I ran a resort up in the Upper Peninsula. And then from there, we'd run that in the summer. We'd go down to Florida Keys in the winter. We had a little trailer. And I did construction work, and she worked in a dive shop. And then from there, we migrated down to the Virgin Islands. And I ran a hotel in St. Croix for about 10 years. And at that point, I've always been very good at managing. And so at that point, when we moved down there, rum was 75 cents a fifth. And people drank all day long. In fact, it was legal to drink and drive. It was just not legal to be drunk and drive. But it was legal to drive down the street in your car drinking a beer. So it was a perfect place for me. And so I ran that hotel, and that's where my disease really picked up. And then 1989, God saw fit to send Hurricane Hugo down there, and it totally destroyed that island.
Oh my.
And at the same time, my disease was at its peak. So I did that management. Now, do you want me to talk about my career before I got sober or after?
Why don't you do it like a little before, and then we'll get into like how you
Sure.
got introduced to to
Yeah.
Alcoholics Anonymous.
So at that point, my wife used to go to the library to study something. Now she Googles it, but she had at one point I got a note that I needed to call 1-800, are you a drunk? And I needed to call this number or else. I'd gotten to the or else part with my wife. Oh, prior to that, we had decided to have a child, and I had our daughter. We had our daughter. Her name's Emily Rose, and when Emily Rose was born, she had blue eyes and pale white skin. And when they handed me that little girl in the delivery room, I wept. I could not believe that I had anything to do with anything so beautiful. And at that point, I said, I'm going to be the best father ever. And I fell far short of that. And I won't go into that, but Carol had gotten very concerned. Things were getting really out of control. And so I was encouraged to call this 800 number, and I didn't know what I was calling. Today, I know it was a central office someplace. And they, central offices train people to trick alcoholics. And so I had this conversation with a guy by the name of Joe, and Joe got me on a first name basis with him. And Joe said, well, tell me, Hank, do you drink every day? And I thought that was the stupidest question. I said, well, yeah, Joe, I drink every day. And he says, well, tell me, Hank, have you ever thought about going a day without drinking? And I said, no, Joe, that thought never occurred to me. And then Joe, this is where Joe tricked me. And then Joe says, well, humor me, Hank. He goes, if you wanted to go a day without drinking, do you think you could? And I had never asked myself that question. And I was honest enough to say to him, I said, Joe, I don't know if I could or not. And then he said, well, tell me, Hank, do you think you might be an alcoholic? And this is what I heard him say. And he goes, and is your wife unmanageable? And at that point, Carol wasn't believing anything I told her anymore. And so I said, yeah, I might be drinking too much, and my wife's unmanageable. I didn't get the fact that he was talking about my life. So he says to me, he goes, well, what do you think you want to do about it? I said, let me get back to you, because I felt the noose tightening around my neck. And so I went home that night, and Carol said, did you call that number? And I said, yeah, I did. I said, you're not going to believe this, but I might be an alcoholic. And she said, no. And I left out the part about her being unmanageable. So she said, well, what do you think you want to do about it? And I went, crap, she's been talking to Joe. And so she says to me, I said to her, I said, well, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. And that doesn't work well with wives. So like 2 weeks later, I hadn't gotten back to her. she's getting more and more concerned. I had this office, and when I got to work that morning, on my desk was a letter from her that said, you need to call one of these treatment hospitals by the end of the day or else. And so I'm looking, and there was a hospital in Puerto Rico, and there's one in Miami, and then there was one in Columbus, Riverside. And I thought, well, I could see my parents while I was there. And so I'm reading, you know, Miami was Dr. Alvarez or something, and Columbus was Dr. Pepper. And I thought, well, isn't that cute? I'm a Pepper, you're a Pepper. I said, well, I'm going to call Dr. Pepper. I thought that was like call Mr. Edwards at Right Rug, that it was just a marketing ploy. So I call Riverside Hospital, and I said, I'd like to speak to Dr. Pepper. And they go, hang on a minute, we'll get him. And I'm going, crap, there's a Dr. Pepper. There really is. So I get Dr. Pepper on the phone, and he says, well, tell me where you're calling from. And I said, the Virgin Islands. He goes, really? I was just there on vacation 2 weeks ago. And I said, what island? He said, St. Croix. I said, what hotel? He tells me the name of my hotel. I look on the computer, I'm sitting at my desk, and here he was in the same stairwell that my apartment was in. And I'm going through the same questions that Joe asked me with Dr. Pepper, and I'm passing him flying colors, and I'm thinking, then he asked me, he goes, well, what do you think you want to do about it? And I'm thinking, crap, grassy knoll conspiracy. Joe and Carol and Dr. Pepper are doing some kind of a deal on me to get me to change my evil ways, you know? And Dr. Pepper says, I said, well, here's where I made a mistake. I said to Dr. Pepper, I said, well, I don't know. Do you have any suggestions? And he said, yeah, you need to come up here and get yourself some help. This was November. And so I'm sitting at my desk and I look and I said, well, I'm busy in December. That's the beginning of our peak season. January, I got a bunch of meetings. I'm on the Hotel Association Board of Directors. I'm on the Division of Tourism Board of Directors. I was very successful at what I did, like a lot of alcoholics, you know. I told Dr. Pepper I couldn't get there until March. And he said, well, good luck with that. And he says, call me if you ever decide you want to do something about it. And I went home that night and told Carol. I said, well, I'm going to do something about this problem I have. And she said, thank God. When are you going? And I told her, March. I've seen disappointment in women's eyes my whole life, but she was hurt and disappointed. And by the time March rolled around, I was in terrible shape. And that's where I started my recovery. And I didn't do it the first time. I didn't get it right, you know. I did it because I wanted to save my job, save my marriage. I didn't do it because I really thought I had a problem. By the time I left there, Carol calls me up and says, hey, they want me to join something called Al-Anon. And I said, for God's sake, don't do that. But she was totally unmanageable by that point. She not only joined Al-Anon, but she put Emily in Al-Anon terrorist training. So by the time I got back to St. Croix, I had a temporary sponsor waiting for me on the tarmac and an Al-Anon and an Al-Anon member. And then I started the journey, and I didn't make it the first time, you know, no big surprise there. You know, finally the second time when I went back out, she left, took Emily and left. And that's where you find yourself sick and tired of being sick and tired. And, you know, I had this guy by the name of Dick O. He's one of us. He was my counselor, and Dick O's in the program. I called him up at like 2 a.m. He'd given me his cell phone number, and I said, man, I'm dying down here. And he goes, yeah, I know. I need to get back up here. And so there it was on Christmas Eve, 1989. I'm in a hotel downtown, and I reached that point where I just couldn't go on any longer. And I'd been going to meetings, but I'd been drinking on the way to meetings. But I tell people, you know, it doesn't matter whether you believe it. It doesn't matter. It's better if you don't drink. But if you keep going to meetings, it leaches into your bones and starts changing you, you know, in spite of yourself. So when I was in that hotel room, I simply said, I can't do this anymore. And I remember you guys talking about getting on your knees and surrendering. And in that hotel room in downtown Columbus, I got down on my knees and said, God, I need help. Please help me. And I had broken so many promises with God that I really did not think that he was going to answer. And he said, I've been waiting for you, son. And that's where I went to treatment. I went to treatment again. And that's where I got a relationship with a higher power. And that's where I got a sponsor. My first sponsor was Harry the truck, scared the heebie-jeebies out of me. And he told me that prayer is a habit. And he told me what prayer to say. And he said, it doesn't matter whether you believe it or not, just do it. You know, here, how do you figure that here, Harry, who was a gangster from Mount Vernon Avenue and had served 3 bits in federal prisons, you know, for mayhem and everything else, you know, and God's grace saves him. My father never could figure out how I came to have a relationship with God through an ex-con, and he couldn't get that connection for me. But he was okay with it, but he never quite understood how that worked. If God puts the right people in your life.
So you met Harry and went to treatment. Did you get do you remember what your first home group was?
My first home group was probably Club Surrender, one of the meetings of Club Surrender, because that's where I went to all my meetings, that and Poindexter. And all my recovery in the early days was down in the hood. And I just felt comfortable there. I just felt comfortable. Guys like Bo and, you know, I'd take my daughter. My daughter was about 6 years old, 5 years, 6 years old. And we'd hop in my car and we would go to St. Anthony's and she'd have some coloring books and she'd sit there and color when I went to the meeting at St. Anthony's. And then on the way home, she would ask me questions because it was a lead meeting. She would ask me questions about what the guy meant in the lead. And some of it was a little bit X-rated. So, but that's, you know, we'd go to 21st and Broad. Our Christmas celebration started with a trip to Lazarus to buy her a Christmas dress, the Nutcracker Suite, Christmas Eve at her mom's house, her grandma's house in Whitehall, Carol's mom, who's living with us now. And then we would go to 21st and Broad for an hour or two. And then we would go across the street to Broad Street Presbyterian Church for the midnight service. And that was our Christmas celebration for my sobriety. And we probably did that for 15 years. And when she went away to college and came, when Emily went away to college and came back, her first request was, Dad, could you buy me a dress for Christmas? And can we go to an Elkathon and go to a midnight service?
Who were some of the prominent members? I mean, you have mentioned some already in some of those groups you went to. Had very similar experience at 21st and Broad for the early holidays. But I didn't know if you had any prominent members that you stood out for you.
Sure. Here's a story that is not unfamiliar in AA as far as at 6 years of sobriety, I started thinking all the meetings sucked. And I would get to the meeting 5 minutes late. I'd leave it, you know, as soon as I could. And I'd sit in the back with my arms crossed. I made the mistake of complaining to Harry how bad the meetings were getting. And Harry said, well, let me ask you, he goes, how many meetings are you going to? And I lied. Yeah, big surprise. People lie to their sponsors. I told him I was going to 4 when I was going to 2. And he said, well, I think I know what we can do. He goes, what are you doing tonight? I was in the car sales at that point. My first job in sobriety was a friend of mine by the name of Rich L. Rich was selling cars and he heard me complaining about not being able to get a job. You know, I kept trying to get a hotel job and Mr. Hyatt wasn't calling me back. So he says, I can get you a job today selling cars. And I said, you gotta be kidding me. That's so beneath me being a used car salesman. But what God does is God puts you where you need to be. And it was a strict commission job, which meant I had to trust God for my money. I had to trust God to take care of me. And I always made enough money to pay my obligations. And so I'm selling cars. And Harry said, what are you doing tonight? I said, well, I get off at 5. He says, great. He goes, I'm going to have some friends pick you up. We'll go to a meeting. And so this chartreuse Audi pulls up in front of the car lot, and all my, the salesmen are all looking out the window, and Troy gets out of the car in a full mink coat with a mink fedora, and him and another buddy grab me and wedge me in the back seat, and we swing by and we pick Harry up at Club Surrender, and we head to Marion Prison. And when we got to Marion Prison, they duck walked me right to the front gate. And Harry says, by the way, you're the lead tonight. And so they shoved me in front of 175 prisoners in a cafeteria. And I'm just scared to death, you know. I told my story and these prisoners were respectful. That's where I met Stan. These prisoners were respectful and showed me compassion and all thanked me afterwards, you know, and we walked out of that place and I realized that, you know, suddenly meetings were good. Life was good. It's hard to be, it's hard to have a pity party when you just walk out of a prison. And so that started a 6-8 year stint of going to prison meetings. And there was a guy, by a friend of mine that I went to a lot of meetings with by the name of Tony. And Tony, we would talk AA on the way to the meeting and we'd talk on the way back, and we'd pick up 2, 3, 4 people and take them with us. And Tony was going to school to get an associate degree in counseling. And at some point, Tony decided that counseling was the same as meetings. And I got to be a pallbearer at his funeral, you know, and taught me a valuable lesson. That's one thing, and this is another. It gave me a whole new respect for AA and the program, doing that kind of service work. And from there, I went down. I was doing Southeast Corrections with Clyde. I was doing Marion, and then I got a job down in Chillicothe. I spent most of my last 30 years of my career being a service director at car dealerships. So the job that I never wanted became a very good livelihood for myself and my family, and very rewarding. When I was down in Chillicothe, I was going to the Ross Correction down there with Frank H and some of the other guys, you know. And at some point, I would, about every 6 to 8 years, I'd get recruited for another dealership, and they'd make me an offer I couldn't refuse. And so my final job was down at Dunning Motor Sales down in Cambridge. But I got so I couldn't find a way to do a correction. You know, my hours were such that I couldn't do correction anymore. I hope to get back into it because it's so rewarding. Well, then the pandemic hit, and the last place you want to be is in a jail during a pandemic.
So tell me just a little bit before we move on, because you're doing such a great job for us. Can you tell me a little bit about working the steps with your sponsor? Is that Harry or?
Yeah, our place to work steps was at Wendy's.
Okay.
Or at a restaurant. And step 1, 2, and 3, you know, he just told me that was a daily thing. You know, one of the things that Harry told me was that during my sobriety, that I would have periods of time that were very challenging, and I would have things that happened that would be very hard. He made to me this promise. His promise to me was that no matter what kind of day I was having, that I would not have to drink if I did that one day at a time with God. And that was the thing that he convinced me that positively I could count on. He says, I don't make promises I can't keep, but I'm making you this promise. And he goes, it will never happen that you have a day that you can't get through without drinking. if you walk with your higher power through it. So when we went to do, I kept bugging him that I wanted to do my four step. And he kept saying, not yet. Because he kept holding me back until he was convinced of what kind of relationship I had with God. Once he saw that, you know, there's a light that turns on in alcoholics' eyes. Their eyes change. And they go from sad eyes to happy eyes. And once you see those happy eyes, you know there's some spark that's happened. So the way I did my four step was I had 3 mornings a week that I didn't go into work till late. This was back when I was selling cars. And so my wife would go to work. I'd take my daughter to school, and then I would sit down with pen and paper and I would start writing. And I wrote. And finally, Harry kept saying, well, how are you coming? And I'd say, well, I'm almost done. And so he said, he wanted to see it. And I showed it to him. He goes, you're done. I'm writing this manifest, you know. And I said, well, when can I do my fifth step with you? And you'd have to know Harry. Harry says, I don't want to hear your sixth stuff. He goes, I'll fix it up so you can do your fifth step. And he called central office and lined this priest up. And so I called this priest up and he said, well, he goes, let's get your fifth step done. He goes, when do you want to do it? I said, well, I was thinking next week. He says, I was thinking tomorrow morning. And I said, well, I'm not quite done. He goes, I'll see you tomorrow morning. And so I showed up and did my fifth step with this priest. And then, you know, when I got back, Harry and I met again and went over it. And then we did my sixth, my seventh. I wrote out my list of amends and my character defects. You know, Harry was always very patient. He also was, you know, he'd give me cheat sheets to look at so that things I didn't understand, he would go to the effort of finding it and giving it to me. And he also helped me in the very early sobriety do some counseling with the veterans, or because I had some stuff that he couldn't help me with. And he was able to see that. And I can remember in the early days, I was going to other programs with Harry. I was going to 2 other different programs. And I kept, in the very early part, I noticed that Harry and his buddies were all going to AA. And I said, how come you go to AA? And he goes, well, it works better for me. He goes, I think they got it together better. And I said, well, I thought it was an honest program. I'm not so sure I'm an alcoholic. And he says, Hank, do you think you can remember how to lie? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, just lie and tell them you are. So that's how I started. That's how I made the bridge from the other programs to AA, is that I would just lie. And then, you know how that works. After a while, I figured out that, yeah, I guess I am. So Harry had that kind of compassion.
At that time, do you remember who Harry's sponsor was?
It was an old timer from Poindexter, but you know, I kind of vaguely remember a face, but I don't remember the name.
You want to share any of your experiences working the 12 steps with the men that you sponsor?
Yeah. What a rewarding part of this program. One of my real cherished things that the pandemic brought, you know, I've always worked with 2-3 guys, you know. By the time the pandemic hit, I had about 6 or 7 guys I was working with. And all of a sudden, I couldn't see them at meetings anymore. So what I did is I started you're probably not supposed to do this, but I started a closed meeting on Thursday night just for the guys I sponsor. And we do the daily reflections. And it has become one of the fondest things and brings me the most joy. And we do some sharing that's deep. And what's come out of that is that they've brought in people now that they sponsor. I just recently changed sponsors because my sponsor, Fred H., has got dementia really bad, and he's in a place for that. And it'd be great if I was doing my fifth step, because he wouldn't be able to remember it. But I needed to do that. So I picked a guy by the name of Rich that's in my Saturday men's meeting. And so now we have this meeting on Thursday that is probably 12, sometimes 13 guys, and it's guys I sponsor and the guys they sponsor. We can just watch the people and how their lives are being enriched. And I mean, it's just, people complain about Zoom meetings, but I got to tell you that there is something about being able to see the face when people are sharing. It's been a very, very good experience. And I've watched guys come in broken, and suddenly they have happy eyes and their lives, all those miracles. I got a young man that's gotten kicked out of school and lost everything, and now he's on the dean's list and he's going to graduate in nursing. And, you know, I mean, you just watch these miracles happen right in front of you. Just watch them bloom and flower. It's just amazing to me. It's just amazing to me. It's probably the most rewarding thing that I can imagine. The other thing I'll tell you is, when I was working down to Cambridge, I had an hour drive in the morning and an hour drive coming back. And that's, I'm no longer employed, because when the pandemic hit, we did a bunch of layoffs and then I laid myself off. So I was going to probably retire this year anyway. So, but now I'm wondering if that was a good move. But anyway, on the drive there, I had an alcoholic that I sponsored that we talked every morning on the way there. And then on the way back, I had another guy that I sponsored, and we talked every single day. And it made the ride enjoyable, and it made that connection, so that sometimes we don't talk about anything other than what's going on today. You know, nothing deep, nothing heavy. One of the best parts of AA is sponsorship.
Has there been any like aha moments or an experience that was especially meaningful or important for you in your sobriety that comes to mind?
Well, I told you before Susan came on the meeting, I told you about Prison Paul, and that left a, Susan, I'll tell you, there's a guy by the name of Prison Paul that was, his whole life was going to Southeast Correction. I think he did at one point three meetings a week there, maybe four. And he got pancreatic cancer and was dying from it. And it was really obvious to watch him. He was jaundiced and he was in his final. And he kept going to that meeting no matter how sick he was. And the final, he did a lead with these men in prison and told them goodbye. And did his story with them and told them how much they had meant to him and how much he loved them, and that he wouldn't be back, but that was okay. He was moving on, and he died 2-3 days later. And it was like, you know, only in AA can you see that humility happen and that courage. And you know, it's the seventh step prayer, that putting everything ahead of you, you know what I mean? Even when you were sick as a dog, dying of pancreatic cancer and in horrible pain, you know, it blew me away. And then I don't know if you guys knew Blind Don. So here's a Blind Don story. He decided to go on his last, we used to all go down to the men's Al-Anon AA convention down in North Carolina. And that was just a tremendous spiritual trip, like going to Mecca or something, you know? And so one of his last trips, he'd gotten this newcomer that said he was going to drive. He'd drive him down there. And they got to, I don't know if you've heard the story, but he got to Tennessee. And they stop for gas. And the newcomer goes into the bathroom and shoots up and passes out in the bathroom. And Don's standing out there waiting for his newcomer to come out. And there's big commotion. And then the police show up and they break the door down. And he to get this guy Narcan so before he dies. And Don's standing there, and they haul him off in the ambulance. And Don's standing there going, how am I going to get down to the men's convention? The Tennessee Highway Patrolman says, I'll get you to the North Carolina border. And he drives them to the North Carolina border, and he radios ahead, and he has the North Carolina Highway Patrol pick him up. And the North Carolina Highway Patrol takes him to the door of this monastery that we do this convention in. And Don shows up, you know, in a highway patrol car, and all these alcoholics go, well, hey, Don, only in AA, huh?
Only in AA. That's a great story. Tell me, or describe some of the AA service you may have been involved with at your group or district area or Area 53 or intergroup.
You know, I did early on, I did a stint of being a GSR, and I hated it. it was, you know, I know that's selfish, but it was just something that maybe I was too young in the program to do it. And so other than being secretary, I was secretary for years of the Baltimore group, and I was secretary for years of a men's group that we started in Baltimore. When I moved to Baltimore, there was one meeting, and we expanded that to a men's meeting on Monday. I've never, because of my work schedule, I've never had the time to get involved with hospitals and prisons, although, you know, I have the time now, and the pandemic's starting to wind down, so it may be something I jump into. I've been to a bunch of world conventions. My first one was San Diego. Now, here's an amends story. One of the amends I owed was to this couple that was on the board of directors of this condominium hotel I ran in St. Croix. And they just didn't like them. You know, we'd go out to dinner and they never drank. And I just didn't like them. And they just were party poopers, you know. And so I wasn't real nice to them. And they were certainly nice to me, but I gave them a wide berth. And they were on my amends list because I had said some things behind their back that wasn't nice and wasn't necessary. And so I'm at the World Convention in San Diego, and it's Saturday night, and we're in the stadium with 75,000 recovering alcoholics. Wow. And I'm looking down over this thing, and I look down the row I'm sitting in, and I'm going, boy, that woman looks familiar. I'm thinking about it, and I look over, and she's looking at me, and then I'm looking at her, and I go, Nancy? And she goes, Hank? And it was the woman I needed to make amends to. She was from New York, and I see her in San Diego at the World Convention, and I had no idea that she was in the program. And I said, Nancy, I owe you an amends. And I made it. And she says, Hank, George and I prayed that you would find this fellowship. And I'm thinking, well, that's why I didn't like her. Yeah. And so I did that World Convention. I did the Toronto World Convention. I was on my way to do in 2000 to do the Minnesota World Convention, and I got diagnosed with stage 4 throat cancer on the base of my tongue, and so I popped in to get a biopsy and woke up and heard this funny air escaping and had this trach in my throat, and my wife looked scared to death. And they told me they were going to have to cut out 3/4 of my tongue and my voice box. We did a second opinion, and I did chemo and radiation and beat the cancer. God is good. I didn't get to go to that world convention, so I'm looking for my next one. Actually, we were going to go to the one that the pandemic shut down.
Yeah.
Me too. Detroit, yeah.
Anything else you want to share since we've had the COVID-19 pandemic that has impacted meetings for you or how you're sponsoring, or have you started this? I mean, I know you started your own meeting for the guys you sponsor.
I used to always go to, my sweet spot was 3 to 5 meetings a week, in-person meetings. And now I go to 6 Zoom meetings a week. And then I go out to any meetings that are in a park. I go to the one out at Infirmary Park in the morning on 37. So I've actually increased the number of meetings that I go to because of Zoom. And I don't go to any inside meetings at all, but I do go to outside meetings if they're, you know, in a park.
Are you aware of members who have maybe slipped through the cracks because of Zoom? Or
Lots and lots. And I tell them, you know, one of the things that Harry told me when I asked him to be my sponsor, he said, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yeah. And he goes, no. Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yes, I am. He goes, well, I'm going to hold you to that. So that was my oath to Harry, that I was willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. And I tell guys, there's been just, I can't tell you how many guys that say, I don't like Zoom. And my answer is always the same. I don't like to get drunk. I don't like to feel restless, irritable, and discontent. And you may not like Zoom, but what does that have to do with it? When I went to my first AA meeting, I didn't like it. Right?
Do you remember where that was?
Well, my very first AA meeting, I was sitting in the basement in the cafeteria at Riverside Hospital. And I'm sitting there and I got my arms crossed and I'm looking around and I'm thinking to myself, man, what a bunch of losers. And then I look down and I see I'm in pajamas with fuzzy slippers on. And I'm going, well, maybe I ain't no winner. You know, that was my very first meeting. And my first meeting outside, I walked in, and I don't remember where it was. It would have been in the inner city, but I remember I walked in and this old timer looks at me and says, son, if you keep coming back here, your life's going to get better. And there was just a way that he said that it's what I needed to hear. I needed somebody to tell me what I needed to do for my life to get better. And he said, all you got to do is keep coming back here. And I guarantee you, your life's going to get better. I have a whole bunch of people that I don't see anymore. When I run into them, I ask them and they just, the best they can do is I don't like Zoom.
Is there anything you feel particularly good about or want to share with us that really stands out for you in your recovery journey? And you may have already covered it. I know you mentioned your prison work, but anything which is just amazing. Anything else?
Well, yeah. You remember me telling you that one of our family traditions was an alcathon and a midnight service. So at one point I got married. This is pretty strange. My wedding anniversary is Christmas Day, 1976. By the grace of Al-Anon, I've been married for that long, you know, and by the grace of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober that long. So one of the things I did was I surprised my wife and I bought a vacation to France.
Oh, nice.
And this is really weird because I invited my daughter too. You know, you just have to know our family. So there's the three of us in Paris. We're looking for an alcathon on Christmas Eve. And we're on the left bank. And there is the American Cathedral there. And we look and there's a sign on the door that says Alcathon and this time. So Emily and Carol and I go in and we sit down at this meeting and they tell us, we're really sorry, but this is a closed meeting. And we were getting ready to get up and leave. And they said, well, wait a minute. Let's do a group. Somebody said, let's do a group conscience and see if it's okay. It's Christmas Eve. And they did a group conscience and said, no, we want you guys to stay too. So my Al-Anon wife, my Al-Anon daughter, and myself, we stayed for the meeting. And then that group invited us to dinner afterwards. And we went to this little French restaurant and had dinner with them. And then they invited us to go to Notre Dame for the midnight service, you know? And it was just like, you know, God is present in my life all the time, all the time.
Is there anything else before I conclude this interview that you would like to share?
Here's my last God story. All right. When I got diagnosed with cancer, we had this little interim minister. She reminded me of the woman and the little lady in Poltergeist. She had this walking staff that she walked with, and she came to my hospital room and she said, I understand that you have cancer. And we had just been told that if I didn't do anything, that I would die pretty quickly from this. And I was still digesting this, 3/4 of my tongue and maybe my voice box. And my wife, this is the love of Al-Anon. My wife told me that if I didn't want to do anything, it was okay. That if I decided I wanted to die and I didn't want to have it, it was okay for her. And that's some love, you know, to allow somebody to have that choice. So this minister comes in and she says, so do you want me to pray for you? And I'm thinking, duh, I'm laying here and they're going to cut me up. And she goes, well, you have to understand that I can't pray for you unless you give me permission to pray for you. And I'd never heard that before. And so I said, yeah. And then she said, well, what do you want to pray for? And I'm thinking, kind of obvious, right? But I had this thought, and when I thought about what I wanted her to pray for, I wanted to see my daughter graduate, and I wanted to see my daughter walk down the aisle. And so when the cancer is removed from me, 2 years ago, when my daughter graduated from high school, then she graduated from college. And then I got to walk my daughter down the aisle. And I was going to give all that up. Before I got sober, my wife gave me a choice. She goes, if you're not going to get sober, we're leaving. And I thought, I can always get another wife and I can always get another family, you know. And I realized when I was walking down that aisle that I almost gave that up. But for the grace of God, you know, by the grace of God. So that's all I got.
Thank you so much.